The information and opinions presented in this ARC Energy Ideas podcast are provided for informational purposes only and are subject to the disclaimer link in the show notes.
This is the ARC Energy Ideas podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome to the ARC Energy Ideas podcast. I'm Jackie Forrest.
And I'm Peter Terzakian. Welcome back. So Jackie, I've been noticing you and others have been on social media talking about our favorite subject in Alberta, campground reservations. What's going on?
Oh, well, last week was a big week because the federal government opened up the camping for the summer. And each day there were different campsites across Canada that were open. So on like a Monday, you know, like if you wanted Banff or whatever, or certain, or the backcountry was Friday. And it's crazy because you're, well, you can log on like 15 minutes early and then you get in a queue. And even though I was like in the queue as early as possible, like I still was getting like 10,000 position or 12,000 position.
Wow.
But
So are people getting shut out? They must be.
Well, you know what? Because there's so many campsites, I was able to actually get a spot for all the dates I wanted. But I think there's a little bit of people just take as much as they can too. So that's the unfortunate thing about it. But yeah, I was happy. I got the three reservations I wanted.
We're in northern Manitoba or somewhere.
Banff. Not too exciting. That'd be too far afield.
That's fairly popular. So yeah, good.
Yeah, but actually they open up for campsites, all the federal sites all across Canada.
What about the provincial ones?
The provincial ones are a little different. They're 3 months to the day that you want to go camping. But people game that system too. So it's really, actually it's much harder to get provincial sites on like long weekends and things like that because people will book like 2 weeks before the long weekend. So anyway, I find it really difficult to get the provincial sites.
So, and you know, January is just on the verge of coming to a close and we're already talking about summer campsites.
I know, I already have my summer plans already locked up, very organized.
Okay. So, I don't think we can get away from talking about high oil prices and their implications. There's been another step up in prices. It was not long ago we were talking about $70 to $80, and now we're on the high side of $80, coming close to $90. So, let's talk about oil prices. And then we're also going to talk about what public equity markets and the clean tech stocks, which have taken a beating of late, and we want to talk about that as well.
Yeah, for sure. So over $90 on Brent, you know, when you're kind of referencing more the WTI, but it's a real psychological marker to be a $90 Brent. And to put it in perspective, how unusual these prices are, I did some work to look at the last 10 years, and only 15% of the time in the last 10 years have oil prices been
above
$80 WTI or higher.
Yeah, so it is a unique situation, but it's also a unique set of fundamentals underlying it. And the fundamentals on the supply side, I haven't seen, where we basically have Western oil markets not investing into the price signal, into the price rise. Because typically when the price rises, it's a signal for Western oil and gas companies to go out and start drilling. But as we know, with divestment movements, policies on climate change, financial institutional directives and ESG, the Western oil and gas industry is basically distributing its cash flow to shareholders and not putting the money back into the ground at the rate that they used to.
Yeah, for sure. And they are expected to grow, like the U.S. is expected to grow, but really a fairly modest amount considering these prices. And then you combine that with the fact that although we still have a lot of spare capacity in the OPEC Plus group at this moment, it's about 3 million barrels a day, depending on what source you look at. Mm-hmm. That doesn't include Iran. So if we had the sanctions removed from Iran, there'd be another maybe million and a half barrels a day there.
Don't you think that capacity is leaking out anyway through the back door?
Well, like, we don't really know. Yeah, their official production numbers would imply there's still some spare capacity, but you're right. That may not actually be as much there as we think. But the problem is, you know, being that there isn't a lot of growth from the U.S. and some of the other non-OPEC producers, the view is that this spare capacity could be whittled away to under 2 million barrels a day by middle of the year. And then that would be in a perfect world. Let's say we have unplanned outages. There's been some pretty unstable suppliers like Libya and Nigeria. Well, then that would take it under 2 million, which generally the market does not like to have it under 2 million. That's a very tight market. And then there's concerns that maybe the spare capacity would even be lower because there are some countries like Russia that just haven't been growing their production the last few months to keep up with the increases that they've been promising. At this moment, the market's actually well supplied. In fact, they're is oil going into the inventories is most people's expectation when we get the data. However, people are anticipating what's going to happen as we get into the summer months.
Sort of the post-pandemic summer months. But, you know, I want to put this in perspective because this term well-supplied is all relative. If we think about 3 million barrels per day spare capacity on 100 million barrels, give or take, demand, that's only 3%. And if you look at other systems in the world, in the power world, it's called reserve margin, right? You have to have spare capacity in your power grid for maintenance, you know, taking down big power plants and, mm-hmm. and so on and so forth. I mean, reserve margins can typically run 10, 15%. I don't know, you know, it varies by region, of course. In manufacturing systems, just in time or otherwise, but you still have spare capacity that is much greater than 3%. 3% is pretty narrow for a vital commodity. And I think what this is, as you get below 3% historically, the world does get nervous and the price does start to firm up quite dramatically. And also, that 3% is not all high-quality oil. As you go into it more and more, the barrels become heavier and heavier. So I think that this is a very important marker, this 3 million barrels per day, because we've been higher than that, of course, with the pandemic and everything. Now we're starting to get into a very tight situation.
I think an important thing that makes the oil market maybe different than the power markets is we have storage. And the power mm-hmm. market generally doesn't have that. So they need sort of a greater amount of spare capacity for those peaks. Yeah. But we always, in the oil markets, there's been a lot of inventory, whether it be in the strategic oil reserves or in the commercial inventory tanks. But that is a different situation today, too. And, you know, we had a glut of oil in those storage tanks. Mm-hmm. But over the course of the last year and a half, because OPEC Plus has been constraining the amount of oil being added to the market, we've really drawn those down. So the U.S. crude oil stocks are slightly under their five-year average.
Yeah.
Refined products are quite low in general, too. And the OECD, which is the developed world, and the data on the storage levels for those countries is more dated, but it's the lowest level in over 5 years from the latest data points that we have. So that reserve that the oil markets yeah. usually have is not nearly as flush as it typically is. And that creates more concern if there were yeah. to be a major outage.
Yeah, I think these are important markers. And by the way, you know, every industry has its own little dashboard of things that you watch. If the gauges go below a certain level, there tends to be some concern. And the five-year average in storage is one of those markers. And when you go below that five-year average, things do start tightening up. So the combination of spare capacity going down, inventory levels, the commercial inventory levels being below that five-year average, all these things are contributing to a sense of tightening that we haven't really seen. I would argue, like, we haven't really seen this. It's probably most analogous to 2007-ish. That ramp into the $100 yep. era, that seems very analogous to that.
Well, and what was different then is oil and gas companies were putting money into new supply back then, but right. those projects were the big mega projects. And so although they were putting the capital to work, it would be many years before that supply right. could really come on. And so there was this market psychology that demand was growing, 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 and there wasn't going to be enough supply to meet it, which is kind of the market psychology we're in today.
Yeah.
Now, the difference today is, it's really about a decision being made by these non-OPEC mm-hmm. producers to not increase their production. So it's more of a business decision as opposed to before it was like a physical constraint, like you can only bring on supply so quickly because you needed those big projects.
Yeah.
So,
and yeah, so those big projects came on between 2010 and 2020, which is one of the reasons why by mid-decade there was a real glut of oil, there was a price war, so on and so forth, the rise of the shale oils and so on. And it was also a period of pretty quiet geopolitics, and now the geopolitics are back again. I think we have to talk about the Ukrainian situation and the potential implications to the global oil supply chains, because Russia is it the number one or number two largest producer in the world?
They're right up there. And the potential for conflict is another factor that's contributing, I think, to the yeah. market psychology and where price is today to yeah. some extent.
Yeah, and it's hard to really gauge what would happen in a conflict, and we certainly hope there isn't one. On one hand, you could have impacts on the global economy and downturn and recession, which has a tendency to ease demand. On the other hand, Russia being such a big supplier and the potential for sanctions and them not being able to sell into a dollar-denominated market speaks to disruptions, oil disruptions on the supply side.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's talk about the oil. And I think it's probably worth just talking a little bit about natural gas markets too. Mm-hmm. With the oil, it's maybe a little less clear how it could impact the markets. For example, it's very possible an invasion would have no impact to the oil markets. Now, it may still spike prices because there's some uncertainty and risk there, and right. the market just doesn't like that. But there are some potential scenarios where actual supply could be removed. Russia could voluntarily constrain the market because mm-hmm. they want that to pressure NATO, and they know that a lot of politicians in a lot of these countries do not want to have high oil prices. Now, the U.S. and some of the NATO countries could limit Russia from exchanging oil in U.S. dollars or potentially using this SWIFT system, which is the banking system used for selling right. oil. And that would mean that Russia would have a much harder time selling oil, and that may constrain the amount of supply coming onto the market. I actually think it would just reshuffle everything. Maybe certain buyers would only buy Russian crude, but it would definitely cause disruption.
Yeah, well, the shuffling would take several months to sort itself out. And in the moment, this would definitely, I think, cause a lot of the uncertainty you're talking about. And on the gas side, of course, Russia is the dominant supplier of gas to Europe, so that calculus and the politics around the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline and everything. I think this is the coldest week of the year, end of January, early February. So this is the time when gas is definitely the most consequential geopolitical tool.
Yeah, well, and it's interesting to see, like, President Biden, apparently he's talking to countries like Qatar, he's asking, can you supply even more gas to Europe? Now, the reality is a lot of the production from these large LNG facilities around the world is under long-term contracts to buyers that, you know, for example, in the case of Qatar, a bunch of that supply that's not coming to Europe is to Asian customers who have long-term contracts. Mm-hmm. So it's not so easy for them to just sort of like redeploy LNG into other markets. But it is kind of interesting that the U.S. is having to broker some of this stuff to try to help get more hydrocarbons into Europe. And, being that Biden really kind of came in wanting to get off oil and gas. Really, that was one of his messages as he was elected.
Well, the demand numbers show we're nowhere near that. And in the middle of winter, it's a reality that you can't turn off the gas supply, and really high gas prices, I know, are starting to bite in Europe, actually energy at large. It's just, I don't think we have much idea here in North America how high those prices are. They're very high.
Yeah. So let's talk about, in terms of geopolitical events, I thought it might be fun to talk about some past ones. And not to say that they are any indication of the future, but I think what we can learn from history when it comes to how these types of events can impact oil markets. And I thought I'd do two examples. One in a period where the market psychology was a tight market and scarcity sort of psychology. And that was in 2011 when the Libya civil war started. And the price was about $85 a barrel leading up to the war. It was already, we talked about that
right.
2010, after the financial crisis, the market actually tightened up quite a bit. So there was this feeling that there wasn't going to be enough supply and that all the projects, although they were coming, were more long cycle projects that would take a long time to add supply. So when the war started, the oil supply did drop immediately about 1 million barrels a day. So there was a physical loss of supply, not just the threat of it. The oil price went up about $25 a barrel to $110. Eventually, it settled closer to $100 a barrel, so about $15 higher than it was prior to that supply being taken away. And it stayed up there for about 6 months at that level.
Right.
So this just shows you the kind of impact taking just 1 million barrels a day out of the market can have when the market psychology is tight.
Yeah, I think that people tend to forget that era. I'm just going to say 2012 to 2020-ish was highly unusual in the sense that it was geopolitically quiet.
Like, after this Libyan situation.
Yeah, after the Libyan situation. And the history of oil is such that the geopolitics is a major influence on price and price expectations going back 100 years on and off. And so really, the return to geopolitical energy security concerns around both oil and gas is really a return to normalcy. It's not something that's unusual.
Yeah. Another really unusual thing that happened, just to talk in that period, was in September of 2019. If you remember this, it was before COVID, but there was a drone attack that damaged a large oil facility in Saudi Arabia. And that was the biggest outage in history. It took out 5 million barrels a day of oil supply, which was 5% of the world's oil supply approximately. And when it happened, oil price went from $60 a barrel to $69, so a $10, right. about a $10 jump. However, right away, Saudi announced that they could restore that supply very quickly, and the price kind of came back over the course of the next month to back to the $60 level.
That was the eve of the pandemic as well, September 2019. It was also the time period where there was still a lot of shale production in the United States. It had not fallen off as a consequence of the pandemic years.
Yeah, this was a market psychology of glut. We've lived 5 years with all this supply. It was really concerns. A view that there'd always be a lot of oil and it would be cheap.
Right.
And so you didn't really get much of a reaction. Now, if this something like this were to happen today, it would be a much different effect to have a 5 million barrel a day outage at this point in time because the market psychology is so different. But when this happened, it was kind of amazing because, you know, in any other period, like you say, a normal period, that would have had a much bigger impact on price.
Yeah.
And as you know, I know you've been following some of this, but these drone attacks aren't going away.
No.
They're still potentially going to happen.
The drone attacks are being drowned out by Omicron and Ukraine and all these other issues that are in the world. It was only a couple weeks ago where there was a drone attack on the UAE by the Yemenis, who are really fighting a proxy war with the Iranians against all the other countries in the region. So, yeah, this is far from over. We've got a number of hotspots. It was only a month ago, it was Kazakhstan. But, you know, it's just when you enter a tight market such as we are in, small geopolitical events tend to amp up the price and the geopolitical premium, as we used to call it, before, as I said, that era of quiet 2012 to 2019 came in. And so, I think you can expect the premium to come back and stay.
Hey, before we leave the oil topic, I want to talk a little bit about demand. We haven't really talked about that.
Yeah.
It's kind of a given that people think it's going to increase quite a bit this year, although there is a big range of outlooks in terms of where demand could go this year.
Right.
Some saying, the bulls saying, you know, 5 million barrels a day of growth, which would be about the same as 2021.
Five. So that's the restoration of the mobility losses and as a consequence of the pandemic, largely.
Like we're going back to the old lifestyle and the international travel and the jet fuel is going to come back and mobility is going to even be higher than it was in 2019. And then you've got the IEA, which is much more conservative at about 3.3 million barrels a day. So obviously what's being built into this price today is on the higher side of that range. Now, people aren't believing the IEA. But I wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, over the course of the next several years, what demand growth could look like. You know, if we go back into the depths of the pandemic, there was this belief that there would be a real change in people's behavior. We would work from home, we'd travel less. You know, I'm not seeing that. Like, I think people really want to get back to the travel and the moving around as they did before. And I think, obviously, those forecasters that think we're going to get 5 million barrels a day this year think that as well.
Yeah, so. I think so. I think that, in fact, it's amplified post-pandemic. There's a reluctance to take public transportation because of the lingering effects of the pandemic. And also there's this sort of the shop from home Amazon effect. I was looking at the diesel consumption numbers by heavy hauling trucks. I mean, it is, despite all the supply chain issues and so on, I mean, it's back to where it was before the pandemic and in some cases more. And so, I mean, the pull on diesel is still there.
Well, and the electric cars are coming and the growth numbers continue to be high. In fact, there are some forecasters that are thinking that there's going to be something like 10 million new electric cars sold this year. That seems like a big number, but when you put it in context of the existing installed base of combustion vehicles, it's hard to sort of see how that's going to affect demand very much for the next several years.
Yeah. Well, it's over a billion cars and light-duty trucks on the road. That's a billion. So 10 million on a billion isn't much. And then the number of combustion appliances, I'll call them, or devices, which include jet engines and what have you, lawnmowers, is over 3 billion. So yeah, it's impressive, the growth, but we've long said that it's going to be a while before a dent is made. And we've said that actually you're looking at the wrong metric, say growth in electric vehicles. You should be looking at the retirement of combustion engine vehicles being taken out of the fleet, otherwise known as the scrappage rate. And the scrappage rate is actually going down, not up. In other words, people are hanging on to their combustion engine vehicles longer. So all told and all put together, it's going to be a long time before the oil demand curve rolls over. Like, I think optimistically it would be around 2030.
Yeah. Some forecasters are a little earlier than that, but most of them are, you know, in the second half, you know, the 2025 or beyond, where we start to see a more of a gradual impact too. It wouldn't be like a step change.
Now, to be fair, there is a good argument to be made that high oil prices leading to high gasoline prices, which we're going to talk about here in a minute, will incent people or give people incentive to switch to electric vehicles and accelerate that. But even if you double it, the established base of combustion devices is so big, it's still going to take a long time.
Yeah, it takes a while for all that to build up to be substantial. Now, the high prices, they can cause people to behave differently. They could cause people to carpool, to drive less. And so I think that's probably the thing that will impact demand.
Yeah.
And we know that high oil prices do reduce the growth in demand. For example,
it will.
That 2013-14 period, we did see demand growth in 2014, almost half of the level of the previous years, and a lot of that to do with the high prices.
Yeah.
So it does affect behavior.
So, and historically, if you look at the number, it's when the price of oil goes above $80 to $90, sort of that mid-80, which we're there right now, that's when change starts to happen on the consumption side. But we have not yet seen the price of oil at 85 to 90 trickle down to the pump yet, because that typically takes 4 to 6 weeks. The price of oil a month ago was $70. Today it's almost 90. Right? So I'm expecting to see the impact at the pumps probably around mid-February. We've got another probably, I'm just ballparking it based on sort of back of the envelope calculations here. I think you've got another 10 cents, maybe up to 15 cents a liter coming.
Well, and we're already starting to see the media coverage of this situation. So last week, if you could catch any news that wasn't the trucker convoy, there was some news, like the CTV National ran a story Thursday night on the high price of gasoline. I looked at CAA website, which looks at gasoline prices across the country, and they showed in Toronto on Friday, it was $1.50 a liter versus $1.10 last year.
Yeah.
And of course, all the drivers were being interviewed about how ridiculous the fuel prices were, and a few making comments actually that they're going to have to get electric cars if this continues. But the reality is that it's really difficult for governments to change this. I know U.S. President Joe Biden is facing this by-election in November and, you know, doesn't really probably appreciate these high oil and gas prices. But I don't know how much politicians can do to change the situation, but I think you're going to see more and more angst about the fuel prices.
Well, you're going to see more and more angst. President Biden, when was it, before Christmas, did a release out of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. Of course, it did nothing because 50 million barrels is what he released, which is the equivalent of, I don't know, half a day's consumption in the world. Like, it's just almost trivial in terms of offering a sustainable solution to the current situation.
Yeah, there's some really draconian type things that could be done. I mean, people talk about him actually cutting exports of oil out of the U.S. with the idea that, okay, we don't let our oil go out, then we'll create an oversupply here and prices will come down. However, that's not going to work because the U.S. imports refined products and exports refined products on the international market. So all he's going to do is reduce the price of oil here, but probably have very little impact on refined products. So, you know, when you go through all the different things that a politician can do, none of them seem like they're going to really have much of an impact.
No, they don't. And there is the possibility of sort of knee-jerk reactions like restricting exports and so on and so forth. And I think this is something that we as Canadians need to be aware of with the potential of conflict in the world, disruption of oil supply chains, whether it's from abroad. But we, in central Canada, most of the oil is sourced from the United States. The United States is now our number one supplier of oil to central Canada. And I think that this is something we need to be concerned about because there are only two countries in the OECD that don't have a strategic petroleum reserve, and that is Norway and Canada. Right? All the other countries have a strategic petroleum reserve in the event of outage. And so we are in a pretty precarious situation as a nation and a rather peculiar situation given that we are the fourth largest producer of oil and gas in the world. But as we know, most of that oil and gas is produced in Western Canada and goes down south. So the geopolitics between the U.S. and Canada could be quite interesting in the event of global disruptions to the supply chains. Okay, what are we talking about now?
Let's finish off with the public equity markets. We don't have too much time, but I thought we'd just touch on, there's been some major moves here.
Yeah.
The overall markets are really under pressure. The S&P is down around 10% year to date at the time of recording. And that's the overall market, so a basket of companies. And there's a lot of reasons for this weakness. Some of them could be, you know, the interest rate hikes that, you know, are coming. We keep hearing, we've heard last week, they're not coming right now, but they will be coming this year. Ongoing inflation, which may slow down how much people buy and the economic growth. Policy uncertainty for some, like, for example, for the clean energy names, like there's a lot of uncertainty about this Build Back Better bill, which is now kind of on hold.
Yeah.
Economic growth uncertainty. I don't know if you noticed the IMF downgraded the outlook for global economic growth last week. And just a whole bunch of factors, I think, weighing down the overall markets.
Yeah.
Now, I wanted to focus, though, on clean energy versus oil and gas, because that has actually done something a little different. Clean energy is actually down quite a bit more than the overall market. So if we look at the Wilder Hill Clean Energy Index, which is a mix of energy transition companies, including renewables, EVs, hydrogen, and lots of other different categories, it's down about 25% year to date. So down much more than the overall market.
Yeah, and it's down double that. I think it's down 60% over the course of a year.
Oh, right, yeah, from the highs of about this time last year.
Yeah, and we have other clean energy stocks, the ones that are, I'll call it riskier or have a more uncertain expectation and outlook, the hydrogen stocks. Some of the hydrogen stocks are down up to 80%. Relative to where they were a year ago. So we're seeing a little bit of a replay of what happened about 20 years ago, where there's sort of this huge exuberance and expectations of unending growth with no impediment. But now we do have impediment looming. We have inflation, we have potentially rising interest rates, we've got all this sort of energy insecurity and uncertainty.
Yeah, policy uncertainty.
Pandemic uncertainty, you name it. I mean, and so whenever things get risky, the stocks that are highly valued and are, let's just say, you know, their money-making horizon is many years out, are the first to suffer.
Well, and, you know, the issue is, too, a lot of these clean energy equities had very high valuations. So the amount, the share prices were representing many times more than their annual sales, and they had high valuation multiples. And so even with this pullback, they still have relatively high valuation multiples compared to many other groups of companies on the stock exchange.
Yeah, I'd say that, you know, the bad news is that a lot of people have lost money on this, which is not a good thing because it leaves a sour taste, a lingering sour taste in the minds of those investors. On the flip side, say the moderating valuations of clean energy stocks is an opportunity for investors who were skeptical of those high valuations and now potentially have an opportunity to get in at a lower risk return premium. So I think that, you know, on balance, I wouldn't say this is a good thing for clean energy stocks. It's never a good thing when people lose money. On the other hand, a return to some moderation and less irrational exuberance, as Alan Greenspan said in 1997 or something like that, the ex-Federal Reserve Chairman of the United States, when we had a whole bunch of people chasing stocks, thinking they're going to change the world overnight. I think this is actually a good thing. I think you're going to see what we really need, which is what we call in the investment business, a flight to quality. In other words, really good companies that do have the potential to change the world and make money with their clean energy propositions. I think it's going to be much better investment climate for them.
Yeah. Yeah. No, there's still a lot of opportunity. A lot of these companies are going to grow. And inflation, it's a headwind. Yeah, policy uncertainty, a headwind. But there's still a lot of growth potential in many of these companies. But hey, let's talk about oil and gas, which is really bucking this overall trend, is actually up 13% year-to-date.
Oh, the equity markets,
Where the S&P is down 10%, the E&P index, the S&P TSX, that's the Canadian index, is up 13%. And I actually had this little factoid that I got on Friday. all but one of the S&P 500's top performers this year are oil companies. Mm. So it has a chart that shows Halliburton, Schlumberger, Occidental, Exxon, ConocoPhillips, on and on. All of them like gains, you know, 20% to 35% year to date, and really outperforming the overall
market.
Yeah, well,
I think it's a real reversal of fortune. Everybody thought the industry was dead. It's the end of oil, et cetera, et cetera. Now we're finding out that, wait a minute, we still need this stuff. It's got to be part of the transition. When you think about other dimensions like energy security, affordability, and so on. So it's very much a dynamic situation in the world of energy between incumbent systems dominated by fossil fuels and the new substitute systems that we seek to transition into. And it's going to be volatile. We said that in our first podcast of the year. We said it's going to be very up and down and volatile and uncertain. And guess what? Closing off January, it's volatile.
Yeah, it definitely is. Good. Well, I think we've covered a lot of ground today. Thank you so much for joining our podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, please rate us on the app that you listen to and tell someone else about us.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.